Thank you so much. It's super nice to be back. Yeah, I'm going to be talking about, like the 10 best things to do in deep learning in case you're a tourist and just dropping in and not familiar with the area yet. More earnestly, I've been got involved into deep learning around the beginning of my PhD. So I've done a lot of work that is machine learning applied to physics, machine learning, deep learning. I use those two interchangeably. But at some point, I got like my interest shifted towards deep learning itself, namely understanding these systems. Why do they work? How do they work exactly? Now, in the field of deep learning, the pace at which this field, the research field, is going is super intense. Being a researcher in that field, like, most people just struggle to keep up because there are thousands and thousands of publications every year. There are about four main conferences every year, and people submit to conferences rather than to journals. And each of these main big conferences has about 3,000 submissions. So 3,000 times four, this is the number of submissions per year. You can't imagine the level of noise, the level, but also the level of progress that is happening.
So how many are accepted a year out of those 2,000?
Maybe like a, I'm not sure. I don't want to give a wrong estimate, but 1,000 maybe 500, depends on the venue too. And I know they've been cracking down on like when the submission, when the acceptance levels were too high, people, the reviewers were told, like, you got to keep it down. We cannot accept that many because we want to keep a level of prestige, so to say. But the whole review process is random because just because of the sheer volume. Every reviewer is also typically a participant, and people get about eight papers assigned to review within a frame of like 3, 4 weeks. It's all very, very crazy. There is no lack of empirical results because indeed the field, it's not everything is nonsense. The field is moving at a very fast pace, but what is lacking is the fundamental understanding. The very peculiar nature of deep learning of this field is that it works without us understanding why exactly it works. And most of the, like, the biggest part of the community, and of course the monetary aspect of this, because deep learning is strongly monetized, and there nobody really cares why exactly the output is like that. As long as it fits our criteria and we can sell it, we're gonna do it. And as physicists, I think we are in the, well, in the position of more freedom, since we don't need to chase those deadlines. We could dedicate some time into understanding these problems. And so today I'm going to talk a little bit about very interesting, very hot topics in machine learning that are still on the fundamental level underexplored. Okay, but first about iPhi. A little detour because I feel like I need to tell people about it. It's a new institution. It's the NSF Institute for Artificial Intelligence and Fundamental Interactions. The pronunciation is there. I see, like, many people ask, what is IFI? It's like IFI. I memorize it as Institute for AI and Physics because, you know, most of them are, it's just physicists and people who work on AI. It's a collaboration across four institutes in the Great Boston area, MIT, Harvard, Northeastern, and Tufts. It's a lot of people. And this institute is essentially a virtual institute, so there is no separate building. People are all across the four campuses. There are four people, sorry, not four anymore, we are now seven, who are the iFi fellows. I'm one of them, who are essentially, like, whose primary affiliation is iFi. And all the rest are PIs and PhD students who have their respective groups and positions at these institutes. There is a link, but I guess I will not go there right now. If you're curious to check it out, there's a big list of people who you might know. You're curious to find out who's part of iFi. And another thing about the fellowship itself, I'm like 2 days late, I think, to give this talk because the application deadline for the fellowship was 2 days ago. But maybe for next year, something to consider. It's a really nice fellowship. We're essentially, like, the fellows are free agents. We're not assigned to any PI. And we can do whatever we want as long as it's within the framework of physics and AI. And it's a very broad framework. We also had a really nice activity past summer. So iFi is slowly ramping up. They've been around for 2 years now. It's the third year of this institute. And so the past summer, we had a really nice summer school and workshop in August. And I was delighted to see some picklers there. So I'm pretty sure we're going to be doing this again next year. So keep an eye out for that. Okay, and now to the topic of deep learning and what to do in deep learning. I set out to paint like a little mind map to describe maybe like the relationships that I want to discuss. And then I painted in this, oh man, I need the hockey stick. I've painted in this double arrow between overparameterization and sparsity to indicate the tension between these two. We're going to discuss this in more detail. And then at some point I got lost because I thought, well, everything is connected to everything, all these aspects. Optimization and generalization, there is always a, so optimization is how we train the neural networks. Generalization means how well does a neural network that was trained on a training set will generalize to previously unseen data. And there are many mysteries about that. Related to generalization are the aspects of data and causality. Causality, by the way, is something brand new. Well, like it's not brand new in the sense of the topic itself, but there is a community in machine learning that just started to develop about 2 years ago, namely addressing causal learning. Are we learning mere correlations and sometimes spurious correlations when we're training deep neural networks? Or is there a way to ensure that we are actually learning causal relationships? And then it can get really philosophical, but also very technical. Because this is the ultimate goal. If you want to build reliable machine learning systems, we want to ensure that they learn and pick up on the right characteristic features in the system. Symmetry, sparsity, and overparameterization is kind of my favorite area that I'm working in a lot. Sparsity refers to the fact that neural networks can be made sparse. That is, we remove parameters from a neural network and they still work well. And this is in, well, not in contradiction necessarily, but it creates a tension with the fact that overparameterization is so ubiquitous in deep learning, and we kind of know that overparameterizing your neural network is the way to success. You add more parameters, it will work better. Yet at the same time, we know that we can make neural networks sparse and they still work. Okay, we'll talk about all of this in a little bit more detail now. So first of all, like the current trends in deep learning, and this is not surprising, it's been the trend in deep learning for many years now. The bigger, the better. Here is a plot that represents this, one of many. So this is Google's language model, Llama. What they did here, they plotted the validation loss, which is a measure for model performance. The lower the loss, the better the model, versus the number of model parameters. And you see as we increase the number of model parameters, we continuously decrease the loss, meaning that more scale, better performance. And of course, that doesn't come without a cost. It's a valid question to ask how much it costs, like this increment of increasing the loss, decreasing the loss by some unit, how this converts into like engineering effort, money. But if you're Google, you don't necessarily care.
What about training time?
Yeah, that also plays a role. So this is something that was formalized first time in this paper, neural scaling laws, by some physicists, by the way, Kaplan and collaborators. Well, Jared Kaplan, he's a physicist, but he is, I think he by now he just switched. He's now with Anthropic. Back then, he was with OpenAI. OpenAI is one of the AI startups, companies that have a lot of money, a lot of compute. So they're almost unlimited in the like in the amount of dollars that they can spend on the training neural networks. And they're in fact bullish on this idea that scaling up will actually lead to AGI, artificial general intelligence. I think this came from their group, like this t-shirt, the print. So they took the plot from this paper. One caveat though, let me say about these neural scaling laws, it is not universally accepted, like the results in this paper. Some people say that all the results there and the extrapolations were too pessimistic because we see even a better increase currently as we keep increasing our neural networks. One of the main takeaways here, well, that they pitched, and this is basically the caption of figure one, is that we need to scale compute, data set size, and parameters, meaning the model size, simultaneously, not necessarily at the same rate, but like in tandem, because otherwise, well, we might have a small model, but a lot of data, and the small model will not benefit from a tenfold data set. But there are works that have actually claimed that the converse is true. Now, this paper hasn't modeled the data distribution itself. And this is one of the things that relates to data and causality that I mentioned before. Modeling data is really hard. We have natural images. We have like a classification. A typical assignment for task for neural networks is a classification of cat and dog images. Now, what is a cat distribution? What is a dog distribution? We don't know. Those are photographs. Those are maybe painted images. And then what theorists attempted to do in the early days, and some still do it, is like, we're going to model data as a Gaussian mixture model. Yeah, Gaussian mixture versus cats and dogs. I don't know. It's not quite the same. Natural data is structured. It is sparse. And it has a very, it has particular characteristics, properties that are not easily modeled with some generic distribution. Now, being a physicist actually is a really nice advantage in working with physics data in this field, because if we do not work with images of cats and dogs, but work with some physical data, states of an easing model, something that Roger and I did last year, transverse field easing model, just a spin chain, and look at the configurations and try to learn a generative model, an RBM, based on these configurations. There we have a whole suite of properties that we can state that we know about the data. So it is easier to formalize and to describe it mathematically. The struggle is, of course, to transfer this into natural images. Now this,
visually, yeah? Is this all done on images?
No, this was a language model, actually. Yeah. So language models are currently, that's this way, like you see the tokens and the non-embedding. So the paper title is also scaling laws for neural language models. So they worked with transformers. Transformers, by the way, are actually like the thing to study, because currently anything you do, you use a transformer, whether it's for language models or also for vision tasks. There are vision transformers. And those models seem to excel at most of the tasks. That brings people to the scaling hypothesis. And this is what I mentioned, that some companies are, they truly believe it. If you're curious, you can read about it. There is a blog post written by Gvern. It's not that the scaling hypothesis was formulated there, but it's a really nice discussion. So essentially, informally, it states that we can obtain neural networks models with increasingly complex, more sophisticated behavior on any task, on any data, just by finding a scalable architecture. And scalable architecture is something like convolutional layers or the self-attention, which plays a big role in transformers. Once we find that, make it very large. And so by simply throwing more parameters at it, which means more compute, more money, we could achieve a level of a neural network that would be comparable to general intelligence, human-like intellect. It's an interesting discussion and question whether you believe it or not. AGI itself is a very interesting discussion, but like this specific formulation, where a scale means a direct path towards AGI, I'm very curious. I feel like more and more people in the community are convinced about that. I myself am not yet. But there is definitely a lot of money flowing into that, and we might see this in the next couple of years, in fact. Data set independent in the sense that it states on any task and data. Basically, it tells you, like, stop optimizing for your specific task, whether it's, and partly it is fueled by the fact what I said about transformers. We used to have convolutional nets for images, and we found that all convolutional nets excel at image recognition because they have this particular weight sharing, and they're very suitable for spatial data. But now the transformers seem to be doing really well on sequence data, on language tasks, and then there is also like vision involved. And this is partly fueling the argument to say that, well, do not over-optimize to your particular data set, to your particular task. If you find a good generalizable architecture, some sort of like universal architecture, scale it up, and it will naturally adapt itself to solve the task.
That's the hypothesis.
That's the hypothesis, yes. Yeah, that's what people claim. And all about the cost. So this is a small, excerpt from this paper, which is like a short note to give an overview and an estimate about how much it costs. And it's from 2020, so it's a little bit outdated, because current models are also like far beyond 1.5 billions when you look at GPT-3 and those like large language models that people, like companies like OpenAI, Google operate on. It's a lot of money. It's on the order of millions. And this is not a fixed cost in the sense that I'm setting up a lab and I need to invest into this lab or like later maybe. But it's the cost of training this model. And then there is some lesser cost to operating this model, which is of course a different order of magnitude, much smaller. But to train the model, you first need to invest that amount of money. But even if you have all the money in the world, there is still the limitation of hardware. Physically, we're limited by the amount of hardware that is available in the world at this time. And so we need, it is currently setting an upper limit to the model size. But also from the practical perspective, thinking about making money off ML and deep learning, we need to deploy many models on the edge, on devices. And deploying a model on device, making something run on your mobile phone, that requires implementing the models very efficiently so that they fit on the chip. So there is a huge incentive to make models more efficient, to make them smaller. And this is in part where sparsity comes in. This is why practitioners got interested in sparsity, but there is also a lot of theoretical reasons to be interested in sparsity. The inspiration comes partly from biology. So we know that the biological neural networks, in particular the brain, they're operating at an incredibly low energy consumption with unbounded versatility. I don't know, unbounded is maybe optimistic, but still, it's a lot of tasks that a human brain can solve without being trained specifically on that one task. And we know that the brains are very sparse. They have sparse interconnectivity and sparse activations. For instance, it is known from neuroscience that at any point in time, only between 0.5% and 2% of all neurons are active. So this is the temporal sparsity, the activation sparsity, but also the synaptic connectivity. I don't have a number for that. It is also very, very sparse. So okay, we built neural networks of that type. Dense neural network, and I'm just drawing a small like toy network to represent the concepts. This one, it has all its connections. So it's like a graph, fully connected. Nodes from first layer are fully connected to the second layer, and second to the third. And all connections are, by default, non-zero, and they can be trained. Maybe as a result of training, they would be zero, but they are allowed to adjust. Now, there are two types of sparsity, the weight sparsity and activation sparsity. That is the effect of removing individual weights from the training process, equal to removing the connections from the graph. And so again, just to make a visual for this in terms of matrices, so this first layer corresponds to weight matrix, 3x4. All these W's can adjust, they're non-zero. In the other one, the zeros are set and they're frozen. So those weights do not participate in the training process. So these are sparse neural networks. And how we obtain sparse neural networks, the procedure is called pruning. So just the very basics, pruning means removing weights with the smallest score. The score can be based on something like weight magnitude, very typical approach, maybe the gradients, and so on. And the time can also be chosen freely, either after training, during training, or before training. A very simple scheme, which is, funnily enough, still state of the art in many respects. This was, I think, the first paper that tried pruning, did iterative magnitude-based pruning post-training. In fact, the first one did magnitude pruning, and then there was an improvement that did it iteratively. The process is you initialize a neural network, you train it, you take the trained model, sort the weights by their magnitude, determine your x percent, and x is whatever you want to set, say the 10%. So 10 lowest, the 10% weights with the lowest magnitude, you just set to zero. And then you go back into the training process and train it a little bit more to allow the remaining weights to adjust to the pruning. And you do this until you reach the desired sparsity level. It works incredibly well. Like with this method, well, before we get to dynamic sparse training, with this method, pruning based on magnitude after training, if you do this after training, we can remove between like 90, 95, in some cases 99% of the weight. It's incredible. And this is a really, really interesting and direct highlight of the fact that neural networks are strongly overparameterized. The caveat is we can do this easily after training, but not before training. Pruning before training still remains unsolved. So that means the people have argued that intuitively the optimization procedure that we're using, stochastic gradient descent, requires to have the entire loss landscape with all the weights present in the beginning in order to be able to move in any direction and find the minimum efficiently. But once we are in the minimum, we don't care about most of the weights anymore. We can remove them, and the functionality of the neural network is preserved by the 1% remaining or 10% remaining. Dynamic sparse training is an alternative, a more sophisticated method. So essentially, with the goal of achieving sparsity at initialization, people have tried pushing this, the period, like the time of pruning, earlier and earlier. Dynamic sparse training initializes the neural network with a particular sparsity, and during training reshuffles the connections. It just checks which ones would have a large gradient, for instance, and if there is a large gradient in that connection which is actually currently pruned, we will reintroduce this connection. So it's like pruning and regrowing. And those two works really well, but nevertheless, we remain limited to the neural network that we can possibly implement on the current hardware, maybe with this particular level of sparsity. But we cannot really go beyond, and we don't know how to optimize the sparsity before we even train. Is it even possible? Is it data set dependent? All these questions are still open questions. And here's something that maybe you have heard about. It refers to a paper that is called the lottery ticket hypothesis that made quite a splash around 2019. It has drastically increased the interest of the community in this field of neural network sparsity and pruning. This is the scheme, basically describes this experiment. So we have a neural network at initialization. So starting with the dense one, we train it and obtain a solution. The dense solution is good. It works well on our task. We then prune the dense neural network, obtain a prune solution with way fewer weights. It still works well. Like there's a good behind the little logo on the screen. Okay, so the prune solution works well. Now, if we take the sparsity pattern, this is what we call mask, and we apply this mask at initialization. And that means we just randomly initialize the weights again. But now we have way fewer weights. And we try training this. The result is going to be bad. It's going to be a poor solution. It doesn't work. Now, what Jonathan Frankel and his supervisor, Michael Karba, found that the key is to transfer the initialization values. So notice, previously we had random initialization, meaning these weights are drawn from a Gaussian distribution with some standard deviation and typically mean zero. These are also drawn from the Gaussian distribution. So they are random from the same distribution, but they're not identical. Now, if you transfer the identical weights, the weight values for the remaining ones and the mask, then you'll be able to train the sparse neural network and you will obtain a good solution. What does it tell us about the loss landscape? What does it tell us about the neural networks, and how can we make sense of this? Machine learning community is typically incentivized to make use of any of the result of this type. They're like, okay, cool, can we apply this? But there is still a huge gap in understanding. Now, a small caveat, this here, the lottery ticket hypothesis. Oh yeah, let me explain why it's called the lottery ticket. So they call this the winning combination between initialization and the mask. So this is the winning ticket. So you need both the initialization and the mask, and then you have a neural network that is going to be well trainable. So that's the reference with the lottery. Now, the small caveat is what I presented before, what they found works only in the small neural networks and relatively easy tasks. When you try to scale it up And of course, this is the first that the machine learning community does. Let's scale it up. Oh, it fails. Yeah?
So if there you use SGD, you need also need to transfer the other video data?
To transfer what?
The other video data into the model?
It's a really good question. So this is partly the analysis that they have done in this paper, stabilizing the lottery ticket output. Actually, no, it's another paper, but by the same subset or like some subset of these authors. It's called Linear Mode Connectivity and the Lottery Ticket Hypothesis. They have looked into the, what they call SGD noise, but they do not mean the stochasticity, but, well, to some extent, it's like the order of mini batches that the neural network is presented with. How much does it affect the solution? Because you would end up with a similarly good solution, but it will be not identical, right? So, yeah, that paper is exactly like a reference for what you're asking about. They found that, okay, let me first explain this and then. So if you scale up and try to do the same, transferring the initialization doesn't work. You need to transfer the weight values from an early snapshot in training. So you need to train the dense model for a little bit, for a couple of iterations, depending on the model. Like the bigger the model, the longer you'll need to train it. And then you grab the values of the weights, transfer them, and then take also the mask from the final pruned model, and then the sparse model trains. Now, there's a lot of cheating, of course. Like, it's not like, whoa, we're finding a sparse solution. The information is, of course, encoded in this whole like training process, and note, we do need to train the dense network in the first place. It's a lot of cost. Like, training the dense network, pruning it, so people want to get there, and they're still looking at it for the shortcut. They haven't found it yet. It's open.
I have a question.
Yeah?
Is there a measure of how different these masks are as kind of like a ratio of how different the weights are if you reinitialize?
It's a question that people have asked themselves. I don't think anybody found a good answer. So yeah, it's a good idea to see, well, is there something common among all these sparsity masks? Do the masks that work well with a particular initialization that works well, is there some correlation, but really hard to tell. Yeah, and about this linear mode connectivity, actually this is something that will come up in further later slides, but the people who studied this and this SGD noise, they have found that this whole procedure works only if the SGD noise doesn't destabilize the solution that much. And by that much, well, they have introduced some metric, but essentially, if a neural network, a dense neural network at initialization, that is trained with different order of mini batches, achieves, converges to the same loss basin, then it's all going to be good, then this procedure will work. If it doesn't, if a different order of SGD mini batches takes it to a different loss basin, then this procedure will break. This is another piece of the puzzle. We'll talk about mode connectivity a little bit more in a bit. Okay, so some challenges associated with sparsity. Efficient implementation and acceleration. We might even find algorithms for pruning or making neural networks sparse. But implementing the neural networks in their sparse state such that they're efficient, that they actually allow you to harness the benefits that they promise theoretically, is very hardware dependent and absolutely non-trivial. So here is a little mnemonic, you know, block sparsity versus unstructured sparsity. Unstructured sparsity cannot be implemented well on GPUs because it brings an overhead of lookups when your indices are scattered and you need to be pulling out arrays like in a random order. That leads to a lot of computational overhead and you need to go to 99.95% sparsity in order to overcome this overhead. So it's basically pointless implementing this in the standard naive way on GPUs. Block sparsity can be implemented very efficiently, but in practice, block sparsity is not as good as unstructured sparsity. Questions that need to be answered. What determines the sparse structure of good subnetworks? Can they be uncovered without training? Sounds like a simple question. It is really hard. People haven't found out yet. Can sparsity help us understand the role of overparameterization? So far, we have this hypothesis, which is very intuitive, that SGD needs the overparameterization to traverse the weight space. But is there any way to make this precise? And also something that is particularly important in deployment, what are the hidden effects of pruning? Are we harming the model, actually? Because note, in neural networks and machine learning, typically people apply only one metric, and it is the aggregate metric of test accuracy. So the average accuracy of the model prediction on the test data set. You have some 10,000 samples, you evaluate how the model predicts for every of these, and take the average score. And then you have an accuracy between 0 and 100%. Well, a lot get lost in this average metric. This totally doesn't differentiate between, is there maybe a subset of inputs that is disproportionately affected? This is something that was studied, as far as I know, this is like the first good reference for this topic, What Do Compressed Deep Neural Networks Forget? By Sarah Hooker and collaborators. So they found that particular classes of inputs are disproportionately affected. So the pruning, it might go without any major loss in test accuracy, but where we are losing on test accuracy will be typically for those more difficult examples. And more difficult is questionable when we're applying this for, like, well, the society, I guess, applies machine learning methods for law enforcement, face recognition. And there is an actual, it's a bit anecdotal, but there is an actual case where neural network classification was applied to help judges to determine whether guilty or not in a criminal case. Oh, and then they found out that, the model tends to judge black faces more guilty than white faces in more cases. And this is a very, this has huge consequences in a society. And people tend to still apply it mindlessly. Something about the hidden effects of pruning. I wonder what I have this slide. Yes, I have it here. This is something that Roger and myself studied with RBMs that I mentioned. So RBM is this tiny little super cute neural network. It works really well. It is a generative model. It is really just one single weight matrix. It has an input layer, which are the green nodes here, and then the so-called hidden layer, which are the nodes that are learning a representation. So the RBM learns the underlying probability distribution from data. And we did it on a transverse field easing model and studied pruning of RBMs. So the interesting thing is you can prune RBMs. And the even more interesting thing is, depending on the metric that you choose to track the success of pruning, you might be really wrong. Initially, we trained with the metric of energy, so EROE. ROE stands for relative observable error. E for energy, M for magnetization. The CMSE is the mean squared error for the correlation function. KL is the KL divergence, 1 minus F is 1 minus the fidelity. All metrics that we can measure because it's a physical data set. So originally when training, we used the accuracy of representing the energy. So basically, we train the RBM, we sample states from the RBM, and on those spin states, we measure the energy and see how accurate is this average energy and how does it relate to the ground truth that we have from DMRG. The energy is least sensitive. It is the blue curve here that remains largely unaffected by pruning. And this is what we were monitoring in the first place. And we were like, pruning works really well in the RBM, despite the fact that it's such a small neural network. Well, when you start looking at other observables, magnetization, KL divergence is not really gauged, so it's harder, but still, like magnetization is very, very sensitive. You'll find that some quantities just get destroyed immediately at the very early, immediately, like around 25% of prune weights. And this just highlights the importance of monitoring all observables if you have them. The difficulty remains in natural cases, like what are you going to monitor apart from test accuracy? Yes?
Sorry, was this with like the iterative retraining or?
Yeah. No, with retraining.
Okay. So yeah. This is like the best error you got.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it differs depending on the phase. Of course, at the critical point, we expect the model to be more complex, the correlations between the spins more complex. In the paramagnetic phase, there is not much information anyways. So there the model remains largely unaffected. After 75% pruning, there we start seeing some errors. But at the critical points, we do mess up the model strongly.
Do you have an intuition why the magnetization is more sensitive? I would think like the KL divergence would be the whole distribution than just the magnetization.
With the KL divergence, you see, it's hard to say when is the KL divergence too large. It's a bit arbitrary because it's unbounded. So maybe an increase in the KL divergence of 0.1 is negligible. We don't know. But the physical quantities are more precise because they have a scale attached to them. Okay, something about the weight space perspective. Let me look at the time. What is it, like 15 more minutes?
Lots of time.
Lots of time, okay. Okay, so this is something that is actually, well, you would say trivial, but it's worth thinking about this, you know, visualizing this picture to yourself, because I think this is at the core, in this framework, in the weight space, you can think about many of the phenomena about sparsity and everything that we have discussed. So what is the weight space? This neural network has some 20 weights. So it can be represented as a vector of 20 values. And just for simplicity, a three-dimensional space, weight space, would look like this. The blue arrow would represent the state of the neural network. And then the dotted line is the trajectory, the training trajectory of the neural network. Also, what lives in weight space is the loss landscape. In neural networks, when we train them, we train based, or like we measure the success of training based on a loss function. We need to measure the discrepancy between our target and the predictions that the neural network makes. So this is the loss. And then frequently you'll hear people talk about the loss landscape. So the loss landscape is a functional that lives in weight space. Every point in this high-dimensional weight space has a value attached to it. And when we are given a particular data set, the loss landscape is fixed. And then during training, we traverse it. We start somewhere at an arbitrary point, arbitrary coordinate, and then we just keep moving in the search for an optimum, for a minimum. Now, there are a lot of curious, interesting things about the loss landscape. So note the permutation invariance. These two neural networks, feed-forward, fully connected neural networks, as a really good example, because you can just imagine it visually. The order of these neurons, even though in computers we encode them in an array such that they have a particular index, but it is arbitrary. It is the same as permuting the rows and columns, rows or columns in the matrix that represents a layer. So whether we enumerate these neurons here as 1, 2, 3, one being yellow, 2 blue, and 3 orange, is exactly the same as changing the order. So there are still 1, 2, 3, but now the orange one is the first one. Because it doesn't change the neural network output function. So this is the neural network function, parameterized by the weights w with input x. This is the prediction that it makes. Psi and phi are the respective nonlinearities that are attached to the neurons. Something like a sigmoid or a ReLU function. So first weight matrix W1 times x goes through the nonlinearity, and then the second matrix multiplies it. We have another nonlinearity possibly. This is the output. Now the structure of Wx, when you look at the kth element of it, it's going to be this sum, right? W, kth row, ith column, summed with the ith element of x. It's like algebra, right? Now, it doesn't matter whether I let I run over 1, 2, 3, or 1, 3, 2, or in any order. So this is where the permutation symmetry comes from. And if you think about this in weight space, this neural network, say, is associated with this vector. This neural network is associated with a completely different coordinate, but it's still the same neural network. Now, the consequence of this is that each point on the loss landscape has many, many equivalent points. And in particular, since we're interested in the minima, each minimum of the loss landscape has that many, factorially many, associated minima that are absolutely equivalent. Well, absolutely is depending on how you define it, but definitely correspond to the same neural network function and therefore the same loss value. And they're just pasted all around the space. There is a very lovely paper from the 90s by Hecht-Nielsen on the algebraic structure of feed-forward neural network weight spaces, where he analyzed this and he constructs this weight cone. So in weight space, there is this cone which contains all unique solutions. And everything outside this cone is just a repetition of this cone. It's similar to the Brillouin zone. Like you just keep like folding it and copy-pasting all the points. He formalizes this in his little theorem. So there's this cone such that any point that you find in the cone, you can map by permutation to some point outside the cone and vice versa. Now he has a little interesting note at the end of this paper in the discussion saying that, well, in principle, this means that the only space that we need to consider when we're looking for solutions to a neural network task, like to neural network parameterizes a function, the function is supposed to learn from some data, right? The only space of solutions is this cone. But we use SGD. Since we're using SGD with this optimization method, it's actually more favorable to have a very vast loss landscape with many repeated minima because we initialize it somewhere randomly. We don't know how to initialize within the cone. We're not, or at least, I don't know, he didn't come up with the idea. Maybe there is a way. If we could restrict us to the cone, ourselves to the cone, then we would have a much smaller optimization hypothesis search space. Question is whether SGD would do well in that space or not. And there's some recent work that has picked up on this idea of permutation. I'm actually surprised that it happened just now. It's like from 2022, the recent papers. So one thing that something that in the machine learning community is called the mode connectivity, that was introduced around 2018, if I'm not mistaken, was this paper. Modes are different minima found by different neural networks. And the mode connectivity means a path of generally non-increasing loss between two solutions. The question is, and this is all about like the analysis of the loss landscape, can we always find this path? Turns out, yeah, it's possible to find a path. The special cases are those where the path is even linear. If the path is linear, that means the solutions are actually sitting in the same loss basin.
You're saying there's always a zero energy path between two?
With there is a mild constraint on the parametrization of the neural network. You need a particular depth or width. I think it's the width, particular number of neurons. And then they're all connected. They're all on a submanifold, and you can traverse. It's going to be some complicated path, but there is a way. Yeah. Now, linear path means they're really in the convex subspace of the loss landscape. Now, this paper here from 2022 from Antazari and collaborators, they conjectured that most solutions found by SGD can be mapped into the same loss basin by permutation, so by permuting the neurons of the neural network. Now, what do they mean? So this is the graphic that represents the loss landscape with four disjoint minima. So the darker color means we are at the bottom of the loss landscape, and the brighter color means that there is a barrier. So say we have four different solutions, A, B, C, and D, and they're not equivalent. They come from neural network functions with different initializations, and the neural network functions themselves are also, like, they're not identical. But the claim is that even in this case, you can find a permutation of B, say, that brings B, maps it to B prime, and B prime sits in the same basin as A. So notice the difference. We know based on the fact that neural network functions are permutable, we can permute like any given neural network function and generate different, like basically hop within the loss landscape, hop within weight space. That would still be the same weight function, right? Here, like in this case, it would still be the same FW of X. Now, their conjecture is that even if it's not the same function, they secretly all live in this loss basin, one. And we can find permutations of B to make it sit next to A. Now, this is exactly this idea of the cone, like reflects it at least, that there is this cone where everything, every, like all the distinct, unique solutions of the neural network would be sitting in the cone. It's a matter of defining the cone. How do you find it experimentally? We don't know. So these guys conducted an empirical study, large-scale experiments. They cannot prove this conjecture. But the way they formulate it in the abstract even is kind of funny. They like, we fail to refute it. They do not find a case where it's not working. But their analysis is also a little bit, I don't know, I leave a question mark there, but that's the idea. So based on this, people have already come up with some very, very interesting follow-up work from 2022 as well. It's like a month ago that they put it out, Ainsworth and collaborators. They use it for model merging. So what they've implemented it, what they have implemented is an efficient way of doing exactly what these guys suggested, taking B and A, so having the solutions A and B, and then finding a permutation that will bring B to B prime. It seemed like incredibly hard task because there are factorially many permutations. How are you going to find the right one? But they did some approximations and like, it works. It works really fast. And they applied it to merge models. So you have two different solutions, same neural network, same architecture, trained from different initializations. They both do well, but they represent different neural network functions. There is an idea in machine learning that's been around for a while. It's called ensembling. If we have an ensemble of models, maybe they will do better than one individual model. So maybe instead of making one model larger, we can have copies of one model and then put them together to have a joint decision, prediction. The problem is, because of this permutation invariance, it's not trivial to merge models. If you do it naively, they'll have their individual order of neurons. They will not be alignable. And the result is going to be crap. So like here, the curve that you see that looks kind of Gaussian, the gray one, which is kind of behind the legend. This is the naive weight and interpolation, meaning that we just merge. We have two models, two solutions, and we just interpolate between the weights and see like, well, what happens there. Yeah, there's going to be a loss barrier. But then if they do their permutation, align the models, so they have model A, model B, here even trained on different subsets of the data, they manage to remove this loss barrier to get it really, really low, meaning that we can combine these models into one. And now the idea of using different data sets, this is like one level up. Even this is what's referred to federated learning. Federated learning means you do machine learning on devices and data sets that are disjoint. They cannot be merged. For instance, something on the phone, possibly by using iPhone, you just give the right to Apple to learn from your photo library to do machine learning based on your photos. But it would be a violation of your right, your privacy as a customer, as an individual, to grab this data and to send it to some central, I don't know, supercomputer. So they cannot do that. But what they can is to train a neural network on your data, on your device, and then send the weights of the neural network over to the central computer. So they do this on multiple devices, and then they merge the models to get a really good classifier trained on all sorts of, say, images, but I mean, I take image as an example always because it's the easiest one visually. But yeah, so this is the idea of federated learning, and this is basically showing a path how to make federated learning successful, how to merge those models that were trained individually, as long as it's the same architecture.
So that merging problem must be hard. So you only turn weights.
Yes.
Right?
So you can match by weights, you can match by activations. And you can, well, in this paper by Ainsworth, they present three different algorithms. And they find, I think, that the simplest one works like surprisingly well. And if you were to carry it out precisely, then it would be a lot of compute. But there, they just do a greedy approximation of that algorithm. And surprisingly, the greedy approximation works just enough, like well enough. It was really unexpected. I would have expected guessed that this problem of merging and permuting, finding the right permutation, is not solvable in any finite time. Well, they do an approximation works. Why? We don't know. They also discussed this in their paper. They do one method where they align activations, meaning that data is involved. Activation is what you get when you put in an input and then see what the neural network layer outputs, each individual neuron in the hidden layer. So you would think, oh, given the data, it must be a better way to align the models. Turns out, no, not really. The other method that doesn't take data into consideration does actually as well. There's like a minimal difference on the examples that they've tried. But they were able to merge ResNet models, which are pretty large, work reasonably well on vision data sets. So yeah, this is a super hot topic right now. I think there's going to be a lot of follow-up paper. I think they also scooped a bunch of people. They put it out. So there was the iClear deadlines, one of the major conferences, was 2 weeks ago, end of October. Wait, sorry, we have October, end of September. And these guys, they've been working on the paper probably for long. It doesn't look like a typical machine learning paper, which is super rushed just for the deadline, just to get things done. This one is kind of like nicely written. And they just put it out a week before the submission deadline. You should see the reactions. This is so hilarious. People come out and, because of the current interest in the community, we decided to publish our work too, but completely prematurely. They were working on something similar, you know, other groups who were working on something similar, but they then scrambled to put together an archive submission with like half-baked results, but just because, you know, this is taken off and they need to throw in their stuff. So it's super interesting. Model merging and this whole like permutation. So these guys have turned it into model merging, but essentially it was, I think all these papers are follow-ups to Antazari's paper. Sure. With this conjecture. So something not as popular currently, but I think there is a rise in popularity, related to causal learning. And this is actually by a friend of mine, Lubana and collaborators. They just brought a preprint mechanistic lens on mode connectivity. What they ask is, how does actually the functional nature of each solution affect mode connectivity? Because here, when people do not test, like they have a solution. Solution has... Thank you. Just a sec. Okay, so this is once again the same issue. We have this aggregate metric of test accuracy. Typically, people measure the test accuracy. Oh, model A has a test accuracy of 95%. Model B has 95%. They're equal models. Well, okay, but we could ask, what is the actual mechanistic function that this model implements? And say again, we have an image classifier. Now, there is a known feature of image classifiers that they can rely on different parts, characteristics of the image. For instance, on the background or maybe on the shape. So you're given a picture, a photograph of a fish. Well, fish as an object is very strongly correlated with the blue background. Typically, you'll find a fish on a blue background, unless it's a fish on a plate. So it might be different. But like, that happens too. But there is, people have analyzed this and studied this before, that models very often tend to pick up the background because color is somehow easier. If there is a surface with a distinctive uniform color, this is what the model would learn. And then, you know, everything on the blue background would be tendentially would be a fish. There is, one could argue about this. I think there is a point in it because this is also how humans tend to classify, I guess. Like, oh, this is something underwater. It's probably a fish, right? Or like, this is something on a blue background. So there is a lot of meaning in actually looking at the correlation. But one can definitely ask, what is it? What kind of feature is it that the model picks up? Does it base its decision on the background or on the shape? Maybe it's like distinguishes, oh, there's a tail, there are fins, it's a fish. So this paper here studies exactly this question, the connectivity, the mode connectivity between different seemingly equal solutions. And how is this connectivity, whether there is a linear path or a nonlinear path, meaning do they sit in the same loss basin on the loss landscape or in different loss basins? How is that related to their functional nature? And I will not spoil the result, but you'll have to take a look at the paper. It's a really, really interesting approach. But yeah, it's aiming at this causal learning and it's actually making attempts to define the data generating process. And that's the difficult thing. Like, you need to make some assumptions about how data is generated, at least formally.
So is it believed, if you just train without thinking about it and learn the background color, is that the...
It is, yeah. Okay, so there are different... What I do in this work is an interesting analysis where they actually manipulate the data and they introduce irrelevant, well, indicative cues, something like an orange 2x2 square in the left upper corner indicates that it's a fish. And if it's not a square but a circle in the bottom right corner, it's a different class of image, right? And then they manipulate the data set in this way, training models specifically that tend to, and then the model tends to pick up the easier one because there's the orange square.
I thought, rule of thumb is always just one of the easiest thing.
Yes.
You're training on the XY model to learn the cost of stylus transition, you learn the magnetization.
We learned it the hard way, right?
Instead of the
yes. So in visual images, people have shown, as far as I know, that color is the easiest solution. And so color comes first, texture is a different level, and shape is a different level. So there is a hierarchy. But color is, people claim it can be learned with linearly separable model, like a very simple classifier. So color is a linearly separable feature, so it can be learned with a very simple classifier. Okay, let's see. We're actually, I do have some equation slides, but I don't know whether we want to go there. Because it's a whole 15 more minutes, I just packed it in not knowing how much time I'll have. We can go through SGD a little bit, or we can do a session with questions and discussion. Up to you.
Why don't we stop for questions?
Let's stop for questions and see how it goes, yeah.
Discussion.
Does pruning affect this mode connectivity?
Really good question. Really good question. So let's go back to this thing, the training trajectory. So what if we prune here? Pruning means we are restricted. We are restricting certain axes in the weight space. So say I prune weight number 2. That means I cannot move in this direction anymore, right? Because this is fixed to 0. There is definitely, so it's going to be harder to have mode connectivity when we prune. But I cannot say anything more exact than that.
Makes sense. There was a new paper that came out about these water tickets.
Unmasking the, yeah. I know, it's a current Eichler submission, right?
I think so. I just saw it on Twitter the other day. But
yes. I haven't read it yet, but I'm excited.
I saw pictures that look like this. I feel like I read something about linear mode connectivity between the pruned network and the original one or something like that. I can find it.
Yeah, I'll be curious. I don't think that exists. Or maybe maybe one of the very newer papers.
Yeah.
In the older papers, I recall that I haven't seen any that would try mode connectivity specifically between the pruned and the.
Because that would support your idea of needing the full
loss weight space.
In order to see that these two areas are connected.
Yes.
I don't know.
It's super, yeah. It's hard. It's super complicated. So something about, maybe we have more questions than I can say about SGD. Matt?
A similar question, I guess, is the success of this pruning related at all to initial size of the network?
Yeah, strongly. If you start with a tiny one, you see there is a little cycle here, because if you start with a network that is relatively small, it's going to be pretty hard to train it to a reasonable state-of-the-art level. Because people have these benchmarks. They know currently a CNN with so many layers should do about 85% on CIFAR-10, something like that. You have these benchmarks. And if you choose a neural network that is too small, it would be really hard to get there in the first place. So people never do that. They go to the standard network, a big enough CNN, which is richly overparameterized, of course, by any classical measure of statistical learning. And then they do pruning there. And that works. And of course, the bigger the model, the easier it would be to remove weights.
And so in your work with Roger, you had two cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
H by J equals to 1 and the parametric phase.
Yeah.
So in the parametric phase, why were the errors less sensitive to pruning?
In the paramagnetic, because of the informational simplicity of the configuration. In the paramagnetic state, when you think about the correlations between the spins, like what do you have? They're just, it's disorder. So you have no, like, you have no correlations even between neighboring spins if you're far in the bulk in that phase. You have on average zero magnetization. So there is, in that sense, just not that much to destroy because it's already chaos. So if you don't have any particular like algebraic decay of the correlation function, yeah, you can prune it, whatever, like it will not hurt. There is just no correlation function. At the critical point, it matters. Yeah?
Is there any more mathematical understanding of the effect of the initialization weights on the success of the pruning? Like, perhaps why some weightings work better than others on the mask level could be a problem with the structure of the network? Or, I don't know. It just seems like a, like from a math perspective, it seems like a sensitive dependence on initial conditions thing. Like,
It's a good question. I don't think people have looked into this. So at the beginning when you were saying the initialization and the effect on, so there is an effect on training for sure. People have looked into initialization and they keep tuning. It's like, oh, what, mostly empirically, of course. Those are just like heuristic recipes. Oh, it would be good if you like divide by square root of 2 or something like that in order to account for some for the variance and depending on the width of the network. But I don't think that people have actually explored this specifically in the context of pruning. One remark about that, you need to adjust the initialization. Typically, the initialization is as follows. You take a Gaussian, mean zero, and the variance is dependent on the width of the neural network layer. So there's going to be something like divided by n. Now, if you prune away some weights, then you'll have an effectively, and maybe like there are going to be whole neurons would be gone from that layer. You should account for that. So that is a factor that comes into the variance of the initialization. It works better. The neural network works better if you account for that. But more precisely than this, I don't know. That was kind of a like relatively straightforward. Actually, you know what? I think I misspoke because it's not the number, it's not the width of the neural network, because I'm confusing this with the, like with another parameterization. It is the fan-in, the number of incoming connections. So typical initialization scheme will be a variance that is like something proportional to 1 over the number of incoming connections. This is where pruning makes a difference, because the average number of incoming connections per neuron in that given layer will be reduced. And so this factor needs to be adjusted. So that is true. That certainly makes a difference. And I think initialization is mainly related to the propagation of gradients. So if you do not initialize properly, then it is easy to get into the regime where the gradients are not being propagated from, you know, from the last layer towards the front. And then one could have, in general, like numerical instability. So one could have either the dying gradient or the vanishing gradient or the exploding gradients problem.
So I have one more question.
Yeah.
From the very first part.
Okay.
Remember you were talking about like a scalable architecture of hypothesis.
Yeah.
Which can work with any data.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like it seems reasonable, but you said that you're not convinced. You mentioned the reason why you're not convinced.
I'm generally skeptical about AGI because nobody can truly define AGI. What is the artificial general intelligence? And then people claim like, oh, this human-like intelligence. Well, when you start thinking about that, it really quickly gets tangled with what is called embodied intelligence. Because a lot of our human intelligence comes from our senses that are different than vision. The haptic, being able to do something, having an understanding of some certain like processes and concepts. So we're not limited to visual and not even just like visual and audio. And therefore, I find it really hard to justify that a computer, a neural network on a computer, which is not embodied, it's not a robot even, that we could talk there about AGI. If one defines AGI, then I think a discussion is possible. But then again, how far can we go? And there are actually some nice philosophical papers about it. How much can we learn from a context by doing natural language processing or image processing But only knowing the sound or how the word is pronounced or how the word is written or maybe how the associated object looks like, but does it give you the concept of an object? Now, human intelligence seems to be all about concepts. It's about grasping the concept, not just like drawing things or enumerating things or even like classifying cats versus dogs. So a paper that I cannot remember the authors, but I read that recently, they mention a something like coconut argument or something like that, that some philosophers basically came up with in this discussion, saying that imagine you have an intelligent being, an octopus that lives in the sea, and then it just eavesdrops on a human conversation. Two people on the beach talking something about coconuts. Now, this object that lives in the sea, or subject that lives in the sea, the octopus, has never seen a coconut, it's never seen a coconut in action. It can maybe hear about the context, about like, oh, a coconut grows on a tree. Coconut is a fruit, but then there are all these questions. Okay, but what is a tree? What is a fruit? Like, okay, like some people eat coconuts, but then it gets into this infinite loop of, you need a lot of information other than just seeing the object, hearing the word, maybe seeing the text, how the word is written, in order to conceptualize what is a coconut, what can I do with a coconut, where can I find a coconut, and like how does it belong into my world? There is, I think, a gap, but it's a very interesting question to think through. How do we gain concepts, knowledge of concepts as humans?
I have one more.
Go ahead.
I have a question. Can I go back to that multiple reference design?
This one?
Yeah, this one. So yeah. I have a question about the first statement. Different minimum from pi to n's are connected by a tensor. So here I guess, assuming those two minimums are in the same basin or not?
So in this case, it's just a definition of the word, like the term mode connectivity. What does it mean to, like, what do we mean when we say it? So when we say, oh, there is mode connectivity between these two points, minima or not, any two points, it just means that they're connected by a path on the loss landscape.
But is that different than minima?
And, typically it's used, it could relate to essentially any point, but in terms of minima, okay, because we are mostly interested in those points, we do not look at arbitrary points on the loss landscape typically. So whether they're in the same loss basin or not, if they are, they would have a linear connection. Mm-hmm. So they are mode connected linearly. If they're not in the same loss basin, then we cannot have a linear connectivity. However, people asked me what loss basin means, and I cannot define it. It's kind of like quasi-convex space. But then somebody asked me like, oh, what if it is a Mexican hat? So you have a circular valley around the barrier in the middle. Is it still like, is it connected? I would say probably. The problem is that in the machine learning community, just nobody defines it precisely. It's more like, hand waving. If you were to define it mathematically, I think the Mexican hat would be not a single loss basin, which is a bit weird, but okay, it's like this valley. However, all this being said, when we go to a billion dimensions as we have in loss in weight space currently, like a neural network with a billion weights, or say even 50,000 weights, I don't know what I can argue about the Mexican hat there at all. It's so counterintuitive because in such high dimensional spaces, it really doesn't make sense to come with our 3D intuitions. So maybe that's partly like the reason then why people do not fully define it.
Because it seems like if that is the case, say there is like a maximum type of minimum, then kind of, violates the conductor. Those spaces are related by permutation group. Permutation group is the discrete object, right?
Yes, yes.
Like it suggests there is a like discrete, a lot of, but just finite and discrete set of minimums. This already grew out the Mexican cat.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, the Mexican hat would mess this up. That's true. Yeah. But apparently it doesn't happen. They weren't able to find the Mexican hat. One more question, Skylar?
Yeah. So I was just wondering, this scale is all you need. Are there people that are super anti this philosophy? Because I guess my first line of thought is like, well, obviously our neural networks aren't as efficient as our brains, so why would we try to scale up this technology that's just inherently wrong for doing this task?
Well, inherently wrong or maybe just different? It's not a biological, right? It's an imitation.
But it's going to do a less good job than biological brains.
But it's not as big yet. It's, well, first of all, it's different, but it's also not as big. So there are arguments about how we count neurons and synapses and how to do this translation between the number of weights in the neural network, artificial one, and the brain. And people argue that it's like, yeah, it's not the same. A single synapse from the human brain is represented by a small module of the neural network, not just like a single weight. And therefore, neural networks are still not there scale-wise. Not at the same level. So we are still like trying to achieve the brain. I don't know whether anybody is particularly outspoken against against the scale hypothesis. I bet people are. I don't know, Jan Le Kun?
No, but there are advocates, what do you call it, embodied?
Embodied intelligence?
Yeah, I think that's the argument against it, right? Is embodied intelligence. You need to group the, a brain in a human
definitely.
Body.
Definitely would be, yeah. I just don't have any names attached to this. I can't remember.
I definitely, there is an advocate for that. I've only heard on Lex's podcast.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Well, there is a lab at iFi, part of iFi. Yeah, did you see the cheetahs and the...
I just saw the dog.
The robots.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, just asking, because maybe there's a real dog. No, yeah, this is Pulkit's lab. Pulkit Agrawal is a young PI at CSAIL at MIT, and he works with Boston Dynamics. I'm not sure exactly about that, but they definitely have the mini cheetah that they train by reinforcement learning. Well, you know, Boston Dynamics doesn't do like deep learning essentially, but these guys, they train the mini cheetah with reinforcement learning, and then they let it run against the wall image. Pretty literally. Well, and they were trying. It's just a hilarious video because. This is their demonstration, and they're demonstrating how they're accelerating, how they taught the mini cheetah to accelerate, run really fast, and it was a record-breaking thing. But they have limited space in the lab, right? So eventually, the mini cheetah needs to stop. So they had like a bunch of mattresses against the wall, so that the mini cheetah would just slam into them. Very elegant. But yeah, it was a record-breaking acceleration, 3.9 something, like meters per second.
Can we check if there's any questions on Zoom?
Oh, yeah.
Any questions on Zoom?
No.
Any participants?
Last chance. No, there is, for sure. Okay. I just want to make sure we didn't forget about them. Do you want to, because this is going up on Pearsa, I found out. Do you want to flash in your math, and then we can just like free screen on Pearsa and watch it later?
I know, yeah, but I do need to talk about this in order to make a point. Let me give you just a really quick takeaway without going through the math. The math is not complicated. It's just SGD, writing it out in all detail. But consider that. When you write the SGD equation for weight, so dWt, this is the change in weights, at time t, so t plus 1 minus wt, I, which means the ith element of the weight vector. We have overall d weights in the neural network, and we train the neural network on n data points. The size of the data set is n. Okay, and typically d is much, much larger than n. Okay, so now this is the equation that describes stochastic gradient descent update, which is written in this way in order to like somehow resemble Langevin-type equation, because I'm like in the process of doing a statistical analysis of SGD, trying to make sense of it. What you find is this little term, like this is deterministic. So I split it up specifically into the deterministic part and the stochastic part. Deterministic part, whatever, don't care. Stochastic part is interesting. In the stochastic part, you have the gradient matrix, which you can see here, partial I of phi alpha. Phi is the loss per example, this here, per example loss. phi alpha given the weights WT is the loss function evaluated on the target Y, and then the neural network output given the weights at time T for the input X alpha. Okay, now this gradient matrix has the dimensions n by d, because it has this index I for the weights, the index alpha for the data. So it essentially what it does, it solders the n-dimensional space of examples with the d-dimensional space of the weights. And if you think about it, the loss, the per example losses themselves, they do define this submanifold in the huge d-dimensional space. Because we need to find, like, to communicate somehow the d-dimensional weight space, the n-dimensional data space. This is definitely not one-to-one. This one is, because they're not of equal dimensions, it's going to be not invertible. But somehow it creates this connection. And we can think about an embedding of the data in the weight space by these, for example, losses. And also something that I'm currently working on is to find out whether there is a way to define this subspace in the d-dimensional space, which is actually the active learning subspace. Because intuitively, when you think about this, there is no way for all d weights to be participating in the learning of on these n data sets, n examples of the data set. There must be something that defines a subspace in weight space that actually does the learning, and all the rest is going to be, well, like it's just being dragged along. The problem is that it's not like, oh, these n out of d coordinates, I'm just going to pick these n and they're going to be the subspace. Well, it's not like that. There, of course, are in superposition. There is a linear combination of some directions in weight space that are actually participating and playing a role, and some other linear combinations do not. So we are dealing with some collective coordinates there. And it really quickly gets out of hand because it's hard, but I hope to report on some progress at the end of the year. So we can talk again then. Okay.
Cool. I think we should continue in the bistro.
Yay.
The table, right? So let's thank Anna again.